Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the second last lecture, second last week of term. Topic today is politeness. I hope my microphone will survive. It was put in the wrong way and I don't know how much juice is left. I'm recording, well, in the worst case I'll just move over there and then I use the fixed microphones. Right. First of all, I'd like to all wish you a Happy New Year. Okay. As some of you know, today is Chinese New Year. It's the year of the horse. And we celebrate it because my wife is Malaysian Chinese. So 15 days of good food. Unfortunately, no family reunion. But there's some nice pictures outside as well. So have a look. Happy New Year. The usual admin. First of all, remember there is a deadline for an assignment, for the second assignment, if you are a BA student or if you just want to see where you stand when it comes to how much you've already learned or how much you know. And then I'm sure many of you have heard that there will be an exam. The exam date, I apologize, I should have said that a bit earlier in the course, but I assume that most of you will have heard it from my colleagues. The exam takes place on the 8th of April. Okay. It's, for most of you, unless you're retaking the exam, it's a two-hour exam, 120 minutes. So it starts at 10 o'clock sharp. You need to sign up for the exam via LSF, and there is a period within which you can sign up, and I think it finishes something like 4 weeks before the exam. So you need to take care of this. If you fail to sign up, we are not allowed to let you into the room. You can't take it then, which wouldn't be good. Once during your student career, if something really goes bad, then I think you are allowed a late sign up. But you wouldn't want to use this in the first semester. So please make sure that you sign up when you need to. Okay. Some people have asked me, do I need to take the exam? Can I take it at a later date? And unfortunately, from my perspective, I have to say, yes, you can take it. At a later date. I can't force you to take it the first time round. I'm quite unhappy about this because in the past this has meant that people have started putting things off and it's just basically meant that they never really got rid of the extra exams that they had to take. Because in half a year's time there will be another exam that you need to prepare for. Also, there is no guarantee that, or in fact, it's definitely not the case, that the same people are doing the lectures next year again. So if, let's say, you fail in the retake, you need to retake it with someone whose lecture you haven't attended. So that basically means you have to retake one or two, or in the worst case, three lectures again for the same exam. You don't even necessarily have to fail for this. You just have to be ill. It's not your fault, but then you will be forced to take the next retake exam, which in effect is in a year's time. Yeah. We're only offering it every 6 months. So I would very, very strongly recommend, unless there are really good reasons against it, to take the exam on the 8th of April, in your own interests. Some people have asked me, how do I pass or fail? Remember, you only need to pass. Right? It doesn't really matter how good you are. Well, it matters in the sense that we give you feedback, how well you did. You will also receive a grade. We won't just put pass or fail on it. So definitely you will get feedback and you're welcome to look at the exam afterwards and we think that's important. But the final grade does not contribute, as you know, to your overall bachelor's degree. Please still take it seriously. In the past, unfortunately, we had a lot of people failing the first exam, not because it's particularly difficult, we think, but there's quite a lot of information to take in, and that's been difficult for quite a few people. We're not proud of these high failure rates at all. It's not about getting rid of half of you. That's not the intention, as sometimes people say. But we need to be able to ask you to fulfill certain standards, and because we know that's difficult for some people, we said we don't count it towards the final grade. So please take it seriously. As most of you know, unless you are studying English as a minor, there will be three exams in one, so there will be three parts, but there will be one final average grade. We are also, and this basically goes through virtually all exams that we take, that you will be taking throughout the course of your study, language is part of the evaluation. We're supposed to evaluate language at 40% of the overall grade. 60% content, 40% language. This is particularly relevant for people who are becoming teachers, not only for those, but particularly relevant for those. Yes, so there'll be two grades really per exam, which will then contribute to the overall grade of the exam. You have to pass language to pass the exam. So if the language production simply isn't good enough to pass, then no matter how well you did in the content, you will get an overall fail. This is because we are not allowed, well, not because, but this is basically because we need to make sure that minimum standards of language are fulfilled. Okay. If you fail on the content side, you can only get a 4 in language. This is because one or two people in the past have written wonderfully eloquent and perfect pieces of language, well, an essay, which didn't really have anything to do with the question, but was really good in terms of language. And then, strictly speaking, if the language is a 1 and content is a 5, well, you can calculate yourself how that evens out. That's not fair. So we say if you fail the content, you can't get more than a 4. We will still give you a 4, but only a 4. Okay? Any further questions about the exam, how we calculate things, what we do? If you look at the assignment that I uploaded, these are the kind of questions that you'll be asked in the linguistics part. You will also be required to write a short essay, 100 to 150 words. Do not waste time counting words. Okay. Do it before the exam, write a brief essay and count the number of words, and then you say, oh, that was 190 words, so maybe I should do it a little bit, well, produce a bit less than that in the exam. But please don't sort of try to optimize things as has happened in the past to make sure that you've got exactly 150 words and you think that you fail when you've got 151. You won't. I have a lot better things to do than counting 250 people's essays in terms of words. Okay. So try to stick within the limit, but don't get overly concerned about it. I'm more concerned about content and obviously language than the exact extent. Any further questions? So the assignment will, it gives you a good idea of what you will have to do. And then the final piece of admin, wow, 10 minutes admin, that's really too much. I would like to do some linguistics with you. Refers to the concerts that we're doing next weekend. It's not very visible because it's a bit dark. We're doing at the Collegium Musicum, we're doing a concert next Sunday, Auf nach Südamerika. It's not only South American, but because our conductor is from Argentina, we have some really nice South American pieces of music there as well, plus some Beethoven. And you're welcome to come and listen to us. Right. So much for that. Before we start with politeness proper, I'd like to revise one or two points from the pragmatics lecture again. And I'd like to show you a brief extract, which is a constructed extract, which in fact is out of a Swedish grammar book, and it wasn't used for pragmatics at all, but it's useful nevertheless, I think. This is supposed to be a conversation between two people in the army, and the PO is Andrew's superior. Okay. I'll quickly read it through with you, and then I'll go back to the first slide again, and then we'll look at what's happening from a linguistic point of view. So here's Andrew. Good morning. And the private officer says, haven't you been told the proper way to address an officer? Sorry, sir. No, sir. Not yet, sir. PO walks around. Andrew follows awkwardly. There's dust under your bed. Is there, sir? I said so. Yes, you did, sir. Then why ask me again? Again, sir? Didn't you? Didn't I what, sir? Ask me to repeat what I'd already said. Are you playing me up, airman? Are you taking the mickey out of me? I can charge you, man. I can see your game and I can charge you. Yes, you can, sir. Don't tell me what I already know. Oh, I wouldn't, sir. You know what you already know. I know that, sir. I think you're a fool, airman. God knows why the Air Ministry sends us fools. They never select. Select is the answer. Select and pick those out from the others. What others, sir? Now, what's going on here? There's something going on which isn't quite right, and this has got to do with pragmatics. This conversation is not successful. Quite clearly, they're not talking to each... Well, they're talking to each other, but maybe not talking with each other. But let's look at the first slide again to see what's actually happening. Are there any expressions or are there any utterances in here which you think we could analyze from a pragmatic point of view, from a point of view of speech act, implicatures, indirect speech acts, etc., etc.? Well, for example, those two. Haven't you been told the proper way to address an officer? What does that mean? Well, in terms of form, it looks like a question. It's an interrogative. But of course, it's not really meant as an interrogative. It's probably a command. Address me in the correct way. Now, obviously, from the point of view of locution, this is a question about whether the person has been instructed how to address a superior. But the private officer must know that this is the case, because he's been in the army for a while. So this clearly would have called for an implicature to be drawn, and Andrew didn't. There's dust under your bed. Same thing, isn't it? It's basically a statement. It looks like an assertion. It's a declarative sentence. And very often, declarative sentences are assertions, as I said last week. This one isn't. This one is much more likely, again, by way of implicature, a command. Clean up. Andrew doesn't get it, or at least pretends not to get it. And this goes through the whole extract, really. I can see your game and I can charge you. Is that an assertion? Probably not. That's probably a threat, right? Again, form and function don't correlate. Don't tell me what I already know. Probably shut up or something like that. Okay. So clearly, the indirect speech acts that are performed are, whether deliberately or not, maybe he's just daft, I don't know, are not understood. Now, typically, this is not what happens. Typically, when we talk to each other, we understand each other's indirect speech acts. We draw the right conclusions, or we see the implicatures that are being made. But this didn't work here. So in other words, he responds to the locution or the locutionary act rather than to the illocution of the utterance. Okay? And this is something that I would expect you to be able to see and to explain. Okay? If in an exam situation you don't get the implicature, but you know there must be one, then, well, that's obviously a small problem. But then just say, well, I assume that speaker A means X by this, and this is an illocution, and even if you got the wrong one, it doesn't matter. I have given full marks for things that are completely wrong if it is linguistically well argued. A lot of jokes work like that, of course. Here's one. One farmer met another and said, "Hey Sam, my mule's got distemper. What'd you give yours when he had it?" "Turpentine," grunted Sam. A week later, they met again, and the first farmer shouted, "Sam, I gave my mule turpentine, like you said, and it killed him." "Did mine too," nodded Sam. Quite clearly, Sam is not cooperative. Because the standard implicature would be, "I gave it to the mule and it helped." So, but that's not what Sam said, that's just basically an implicature, which in this case wasn't true. Do I look fat? Have you thought about working out or joining a health spa? Which maxim is violated here? Which one? You've got four on offer. As a rule, you can almost always say relevance, okay? But not necessarily only, okay? But I think that this is a question of the maxim of relevance. Is the answer relevant? Do I look fat? What would be a relevant answer? Yes, you do. Or no, you don't. Does this say yes or no? Well, yes, but only if we understand something that in fact is actually irrelevant, because the answer is not yes or no. Something is said by way of saying something different, by way of saying something that is irrelevant really, but that is made relevant by the hearer to mean yes. And it would actually be quite good if you went and did some working out. So this is an indirect speech act. Okay? That was a bit of revision. Right, so I've brought up the cooperative principle again, Grice, and how we can interpret how something means something quite different from what it actually means on the level of sense and reference of the locution. Yeah. So it explains how we are indirect and how listeners still make sense of this. But one question, another question in this context is why? Why do we do all of this? Why aren't we just direct? Why are we not just saying yes or no? And obviously, this has got to do with politeness. Now, this has got to do with politeness in the lay sense, in the sense of being polite, which would also include, I don't know, getting up in the bus when someone with, I don't know, crutches comes in or whatever. I mean, the kind of lay perception of being polite. But we are today concerned about linguistic politeness and how this is affected from the point of view of linguistic form. And it's closely linked to last week's content on implicatures, speech acts, indirect speech acts, etc. Have you thought about what polite means, where it comes from, It's actually quite an old word. It goes back to Latin origins. In Middle English, when it was introduced, as many Latin or via France, the Norman French conquest, when a lot of words were introduced into the English language, it first meant smoothed, polished, burnished. And I'm sure you know a German word that is related to this. Politur? So it didn't actually mean polite in the present day sense. About 100 years later are the first uses of the word referring to language and a few other fields, the arts, intellectual pursuits, etc. So, refined, elegant, scholarly, exhibiting good or restrained taste. And you can see how the two meanings are related. Remember polysemy, remember how meaning can change over time, narrow over time, or expand over time, or become more negative or more positive. Many words go through this kind of development, and we can see this also with the adjective polite. By about 1600, it could be used to refer to a group of people. So, refined, cultured, cultivated, we're getting closer to the meaning that we see today. And we still have a fairly old-fashioned use when we say polite society. This is not necessarily society where everyone is always polite, but it's basically sort of the upper circles of society, no matter how polite in the lay sense they are. And then about 250 years ago, we see the meaning courteous, behaving in a manner that is respectful or considerate to others, well-mannered. And there we are with the modern meaning. Now, when we talk about politeness, then we refer to the use of language. Well, not only language, of course, use of our actions to support social harmony, to support the workings of our society, and to maintain them. And obviously, I'm concentrating on the linguistic aspects of this today. So I've got two options to do the same thing. Pass the salt, or could you pass the salt, please? Remember the different ways of asking people to close the door. Some more direct, some more indirect. Clearly, the first one is much more direct. Do both of them impose on the hearer? Yes, because in both cases, I want the hearer to do something for me, regardless of whether they want to do it or not. The second one does it more politely in the lay sense, but also politely in the linguistic sense. And this would, for example, be the kind of, well, the way that you would do at a formal, that you would choose at a formal dinner party, whereas when you're sitting with your friends or your family at dinner, then you can just say, pass the salt. Now, in the reading for today, it mentions that there are different ways in which politeness has been dealt with in the linguistic literature. I'm going to concentrate on the one by Brown and Levinson. There is also the politeness principle approach by Geoffrey Leach, which is modeled on the cooperative principle. So there are, in the same way as there are maxims in the cooperative principle, there are maxims in the politeness principle. And I'm not going to read out the whole extract here, but this is from the reading for today where Jonathan Culpepper, who is an expert on politeness and impoliteness, as I'll see later on, shows how this is at work, where he brings bad news to one person, but does it in a very polite way, referring to, and Culpepper explains it by way, well, referring to cooperative principles, but also politeness principles. The overall politeness principle is minimize other things being equal, the expression of impolite beliefs maximize, other things being equal, the expression of polite beliefs. Okay. So this is exemplified by the approbation maxim, minimize dispraise of other, maximize praise of other, as one way of dealing with being polite. And there are quite a few other maxims, and if you want to read up more on that, I would like to refer you to the reading for today. I'm going to concentrate on the more popular or more influential model of politeness. Those two are not the only two, but they are the two basic ones that most people refer to, and they're also they were established at around the same time, independent of each other. Brown and Levinson basically take a face-saving approach, and I'm sure many of you will have come across the concept of face, particularly perhaps in cross-cultural encounters. As you know, some cultures have different concepts of face and also of losing face. For example, if you're extremely angry and loud and you react in ways in which maybe it is okay to react for, I don't know, let's say Italians or, I don't know, some other group. And if you do the same thing in certain Asian countries, then you're basically losing face by doing this, even though it would be perfectly okay in your own culture. And if you or your interlocutor, the person you talk to, loses face, then something gets violated in the same way, in the way as when you... it's again a question of violation, as in the case of the maxims. So, but what's violated here is basically your public image. And that may result in humiliation, embarrassment, and I'm sure we all know that feeling if we've done something that we shouldn't have done. Now, the term face goes back to, or is often attributed to, Goffman from sociology. The linguistic idea of face is a bit of a simplified view of this concept, but it's basically the same. And in fact, Goffman says, or the linguistic approach to politeness, says there are two types of face. And they're sometimes difficult for students to take apart, to keep apart. Negative face and positive face. But I think it's not that difficult, actually. The negative face is your, or everyone's, or every competent adult member's need, this competent adult member is what Brown and Levinson say, that their actions be unimpeded by others, in a way that you're left alone to do what you want to do. Meaning, maybe you don't want to pass the salt. Of course you're happy to do it for someone, but basically it's an imposition on your wanting to be left alone and not to be asked to do things for other people or to be controlled by other people. On the other hand, your positive face refers to your part in a society, in a group of people, and the need or your want to belong to them. Yeah. So the want of every member that their wants be desirable to at least some others. So whatever I think I am as a sort of human social being, I hope is nice or acceptable or positive also for other people in my immediate environment. And you can threaten both types of face. I can threaten your negative face, and I can threaten your positive face. Or, in fact, I can also threaten my negative face or my positive face. For example, if I apologize, then I'm threatening my own face. Think about whether it's a positive or the negative one. And this kind of threat is called an FTA, or face-threatening act. I'll give you a quote which sounds rather complex, but in fact it isn't. But it's the original quote from Brown and Levinson. And this is often the case that when a new theory is brought up, then it's done in a way that is rather difficult to follow. Well, once you write textbooks about the theory, then things have become simplified. Here is what Brown and Levinson write. Unless speakers want to do an FTA, a face-threatening act, with maximum efficiency, is greater than the speakers want to preserve the hearer's or the speaker's face to any degree, then S will want to minimize the face threat of the FTA. Sounds complex? I think I'll make that clear in a minute. And this refers to the politeness strategies that we constantly employ when we speak, or as some people call it, face work. Now, if I talk to you, or if we're doing, well, if we're interacting in various ways, then occasionally I will want to impede on your actions, or impose on your actions. Okay, I want you to pass me the salt. But I may choose to reduce the threat in various ways. And that's exactly what Brown and Levinson talk about. There are several options. The first option is the most direct option. Just simply do the face-threatening act. Don't use any, and that's a term that they introduce, don't use any redressive action. Don't use any action that reduces the face threat. So this is bald on. This is just direct without reducing it at all. Give me a cup of tea. Get me a coffee. Whatever. If I wanted, well, in this context it would be extremely unusual, of course, but if I wanted one of you to get me a coffee now, and I just said, go and get me a coffee, that would be very odd indeed, wouldn't it? Yes. And that's because it would be an imposition on you. I would also probably lose some face doing that. So I would need to explain this. I would need to make sense why I'm asking you to get me a coffee now. Okay. So I wouldn't just say, go and get me a coffee. Or turn your headlights on, which is basically a command. Okay. I might choose a face-threatening act. I might choose to still go and ask you to get me a coffee. But I will perhaps use, I would definitely use some redressive action. And in order to, well, there are two types of redressive action. One refers to your positive face needs and one to your negative face needs. Let's say I need to tell you that you aren't so good at what you're doing right now for me, but I don't want to just say that's bad or you're crap, or something like that. Okay. I could say, you need to try harder, or you must try harder. Or I could say, you should try harder, which is already a little bit weaker. But most importantly, I can also hedge the impact by saying, sort of. Does it really make sense to say, sort of try harder? Not really, but by doing this, I'm reducing the impact. I'm hedging my opinion. I'm saying maybe I'm not 100% not even convinced, but maybe I don't want to be that strong in what I say. This would take care of your positive face, because I'm not attacking the face that wants to be liked. I'm basically accounting for the fact that you want to be a full member of our community, and I'm reducing that threat somewhat. Another example. What is she? Small? Yes, she's small. Smallish. Not really small, but certainly not very big. What does that mean? Well, basically, no. Right? She's not small. But disagreement is an attack on your face. So I'm reducing the overt signs of disagreement. Again, this is an example of positive politeness. Or I could say, I'm awfully sorry to bother you, and I wouldn't, but I'm in an awful fix, and so I wondered if by any chance you could go and get me a coffee, right? And that would probably be still odd, admittedly, but maybe more acceptable, because I've shown that I'm in that I'm aware of the fact that I shouldn't really be doing this. Okay? And I also show this by way of realizing that I am imposing on you. So I'm reducing the face threat. I'm doing this with the help of negative politeness, or with the help of a strategy that takes care of your negative face. But still, I'm basically very clear about the fact that I would like you to get me some coffee. Yeah? Or whatever the example was. But I can feel that that's too dangerous, because I know that in this context I really am not supposed to ask students to get me coffee. Mm-hmm. So I may choose to do it off record, in a way that I can pretend that I never asked. Remember, indirect speech acts can be cancelled. I forgot my wallet. Oh, not again, etc. No, I didn't ask you for money. I just said I forgot my wallet. No. This is awfully heavy. Look, I can't help you. You know, my back. No. I just said it's awfully heavy. Yeah, of course I know. Are these cookies made with nuts? You can't have any. No. I just want to know because I didn't want any. No. Okay. But basically, it's an indirect request. And if I wanted coffee here, I'm not quite sure how I would do this. I feel quite dizzy and I haven't had a coffee today, etc. And maybe at some stage someone of you might say, okay, I'll get you one. Okay. But if you complain to the head of department that Professor Hoffman is asking his students to get him some coffee, I can always say, didn't. Okay. Or in fact, and perhaps that's the option that I would go for in terms of my coffee problem, I would decide not to do the face-threatening act because I feel that the threat is too great to your face and possibly also to mine. You just don't ask students to get you coffee. Mm-hmm. So, these are the different options. And there is a famous schema or famous way of visualizing this, and this is as follows. There are different options. You do the FTA, you can do it on record, and in fact you might do it without redressive action, a bold-on face threat. Or you choose to do it with redressive action, and then you take care of the positive or the negative face needs or face wants of the interlocutor. Or you do it off record, or you you decide that you don't do the face threat at all. Now, here it says estimation of risk of face loss, and then on top it says lesser, and at the bottom it says greater. And that sometimes confuses students. Why does it say lesser here if the threat is greater? Think about it. It works the other way around. If you think there is less of a risk to violate your face or the interlocutor's face, then you can do a more direct face threat. So it's in a way the other way around from what you think is intuitively the case. Okay? Right. So you've got different options, and you constantly need to decide which one you go for. There are different reasons why you may go for one rather than another option. And that may refer, or that can be operationalized or described in the weightiness of a face-threatening act, which depends on various aspects. how well we know each other. There is a difference, although my secretary does not get me coffee, but because of the institutional setup that we have, it would probably be okay to ask her to organize some coffee for me. I would probably feel odd about suddenly starting this now because I've never asked her to do this. But if I've done it before and we agree that this is part of her duties, then there is absolutely no problem. Mm-hmm. But is that social distance? Well, there are various other aspects involved. Power of the hearer over the speaker and absolute ranking of the imposition X in a given culture. So, talking to you about coffee or other things is different from talking to my secretary or from talking to my wife about organizing coffee. For various reasons, social distance, power, and absolute ranking as well. The coffee is fine, or giving me a euro or something like that, or but if I do the same thing with 1,000 euros, then I think we're talking about quite a different face threat. Okay. And Brown and Levinson put this together in this wonderful formula, which is basically the sum of the three. And no, you don't have to learn this by heart. Okay? No. But you need to know the concepts. Okay? And I think it makes sense. Now, maybe when you were walking around last week and I asked you to listen to when indirect speech acts were performed and you noticed a few, you suddenly realized that we do this all the time. We are much more indirect than you think we are. In fact, we're also much more polite, or we are much more aware of each other's face needs and much less direct than you may think we are. And I myself experienced this about 4 years ago in the lecture on politeness. Carnival was a bit earlier, and there were a few drunk students in the audience up there in the last row. And they were making noise. They were misbehaving. And what did I do? I chased them out. I told them to leave. And I thought to myself, okay, that was the first time this happened, and I thought, oh, luckily that worked out. But luckily I stood my ground, and I was very direct and chased them out. In fact, I got some help from the students. Okay. But listen, and then later on I listened to it, and listened to what I did.
I can see your game, and I can charge you. This is a statement.
I use the same example, as you can see.
Of the private officer. Are you having fun up there? No. Well, if you're not having fun, would you mind leaving? Well, please leave then.
Okay, so was I direct? Clearly not. I was a lot less direct than I experienced myself to be. What did I say at the beginning? Are you having fun up there? This is rather indirect. What does it mean? It means shut up, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm doing this in a very indirect way. And even after that, I say things like, would you mind leaving? Or please. So I felt that I was direct, but in fact I wasn't at all. Again, I think this is a nice example of the fact that we do a lot of things with language that are much more indirect than we think them to be. Now, Brother Levinson has been criticized in various ways because critics have said this is all about reducing face threats, but sometimes there are situations where you don't necessarily reduce face threat. It doesn't, for example, deal with impolite acts, deliberately attacking or challenging acts. Or sometimes you just want to be nice, face-enhancing acts without any kind of reduction or face threat. That's not really covered by the theory, a compliment out of the blue. And impoliteness, as I said, is really not covered either. There are clearly acts that attack face deliberately without any kind of reduction of that face. And Jonathan Culpepper, who is not only one of the editors of the textbook that we're using, but who's also the author of the chapter that you read for today, he's also an expert not only in politeness, but particularly in impoliteness. And impoliteness is all around, well, not all around, is found in many places. And I'll give you a few examples from computer-mediated communication. Now, you could say that being impolite could be related to using nasty words, taboo words, okay? Being overtly impolite, like, wow, you are a fucking idiot, aren't you? Okay? That sounds pretty impolite. You can't stand the fact that many, many people think you're a fucking incompetent, quasi-literate, non-Yale-going moron, can't you? Or can you, sorry, weasel. Is that impolite? Definitely. Why is it impolite? Well, certainly there's no redressive action, right? It's just basically attacking the other person's face. And you can see why this might happen, particularly in computer-mediated discourse. It's online. It's anonymous. But is it really just because of these F words and other elements that this is impolite? Well, I'll give you one or two other examples. You really have nothing to back up your statements, do you? That's sad. Is that impolite? Is that a challenge? Is that a threat? Very clearly so. It's quite a serious one. Reading is not one of your strong points, is it? That's pretty bad, isn't it? Didn't pay much attention at school, did you? Yes, okay. Yeah. There's no F word at all, but this is clearly very, very impolite. Why is it so impolite? Now, in those cases, you can see, I mean, didn't pay much attention at school, this is almost like an interpretation of the other person's qualities, right? This is a proposition. This is something, some sort of summary that's claimed to, or that's deducted from the person's actions. Now, look at this tag question. In the other examples just before, there were also tag questions. My point is that it's not only words and the content, but in fact it's also a combination of words and linguistic structure that leads to impoliteness being affected here. This ties into what we're doing next week when we look at discourse and turn-taking. What happens when you use a tag question? Well, basically on some level it's a question. You didn't pay much attention at school, did you? It's inviting the other person's response. But the other person really is in a double bind. What do I mean by this? Well, basically there is no way out. If the other person says, yes, of course I paid attention at school, they've lost. Because they basically say, I needed to take this seriously. But even if, no, sorry, yes, if the summary is countered, then it shows that it's being taken seriously. Yeah. On the other hand, if he says, yes, I didn't pay much attention, then obviously he's lost as well. Yeah. So no matter what the person says, they lose. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because it's a question, because it invites the other person's response. So we don't need bad words. We don't need F words. We partly simply need linguistic structure. Also, another point that can be used and mentioned in this context is that, of course, it depends very much where these kind of face-threatening acts take place. Context is quite important here. We have unmarked norms. If I started attacking you in this lecture, then that would be rather unusual. But there are situations where attacks are very normal. And that's, for example, in parliamentary debates, where you're basically expected to attack the opposition. Okay. And they are very direct attacks. Well, they're actually not direct, because in parliamentary discussions, the people are not, the participants are not supposed to address each other. So you can't say to the opposition, you are an idiot. Well, maybe not in that word, in those words, but you have completely failed with your policy. But you have to go via the speaker. Mr. Speaker, do you realize that he has said, or something like that? So it seems that the right honorable gentleman has failed to do his homework. Is that a threat? Clearly. Is it expected in this context? Yes. Will it therefore not be experienced as strongly? Probably. Let's have a quick look, and that's a quick break. Not quite in the middle, but almost in the middle, a bit further than the middle of the lecture. Here is an extract from a parliamentary debate.
And when the Prime Minister talks about the economy, let's be clear what his legacy will be. Not the most useless government we've had in history, though it is. His legacy will be the biggest budget deficit in Europe and the biggest we've had in our history. So let's be clear about this no plans or no proposals today, as he put it. A man with no democratic legitimacy, who's never been elected as our Prime Minister, who's been defeated every time the public have been able to vote for him, is now considering trying to fix the rules of the election before the next general election. Isn't that what's happening?
Yeah. First of all, on public spending and deficits, let him confirm that his proposals are for a 10% cut in his department expenditure. If he wishes to raise the question of deficits and debts, let him confirm that that is now the proposal of the Shadow Chancellor to cut public expenditure by 10%, as confirmed by the Shadow House Secretary this morning. And let us have a debate about the choice that really does exist in the country between a Conservative Party that now wants to cut, even at a time of recession, into our basic public services, and a Labour Party that wants to invest in them. Let him also be honest with the country that when it comes to calling for election, he has absolutely no plan for dealing with the recession. He has got no policies for dealing with unemployment, no policies for dealing with small businesses, no policies for dealing with the problems of this country. He is an opposition leader who has no plans for government, and he doesn't deserve to be in government.
Okay, pretty strong threats, yeah. But in a way it's expected, and in that sense it's, some people call it politic. This is not necessarily because this is about politics, but it's simply expected in the current, well, it's the discursive practice of this setup. And this is what's looked at by some more recent theories of pragmatics. Just because it was so nice, I'll give you another minute of parliamentary discussion, because maybe you need another minute of a break.
The Prime Minister talks about salesmanship. We all know his brilliant salesmanship. This man sold gold at the bottom of the market. That's the problem with the Prime Minister. He's got nothing to sell, and he's useless at selling it. And while we're at it, I've got a bit more advice for him. This is the Prime Minister who went on American Idol with old makeup on and Barbara Bond. This is the Prime Minister who sits in the limited management. He's skipped in numbers and magazine.
Serious, but I don't think this is the kind of face threat that Brown and Levinson were talking about, or at least there is something else involved on top of that. Okay, end of break. I'd like to say a few things about historical developments, both in terms of speech acts and also in terms of politeness. I know that next semester is the semester when you'll be looking at history, or the history of English, but because it's one of my areas of interest as well, I thought I'll say a few words about that. Now, speech acts are actually quite difficult to investigate from a historical point of view, because, well, speech acts rely on seeing the implicatures that are supposed to be drawn. And we don't have intuitions of Shakespeare and others, or even going further back. So this is rather difficult. Also, we don't have any spoken data for earlier periods of the language. We have some parliamentary debates, we have some drama, etc., but it's not spoken language. So, if the correct interpretation relies on context, can we apply present-day intuitions to identify the force of an utterance? Well, that's really quite difficult. Can we also assume that the speech act just stayed the same? Probably not. So this is actually rather difficult to investigate. For example, we know that apologies in Japanese and American English are rather different. So why should it not be rather different when we look at time differences of 400 or 500 years? I'd like to show you what's at issue by looking at one or two different points here. The word please, something that we use to reduce face-threatening acts today. And can we just assume that the word please was used in the same way a couple of hundred years back? Well, nowadays, of course, we say, shut the door, please. Will you please come with me? Or come here with me? Can I have an extension, please, if you're writing a paper with me? Could you lean on the book, please? I don't know what the context here is, but you can see how this works. Just say, please, may I have my Argus card when you go into Argus. You can see that please often co-occurs with will you and could you to further reduce the face-threatening act. Now, this is not the only use of please. She had felt fortunate in being able to please herself where she lived. That sounds old-fashioned. It's not the same it's the same word, but it's not the same meaning, is it? So at any rate, then, please yourself. Let's have a quick look at the development of please and whether we can just assume that this takes on the same kind of functions. Have a look at how it's used in 1672. We are at present here without any government, the commonalty not only say, but do what they please. Is that still acceptable today? No. What pleases them, maybe. It's a different grammatical structure. And it's certainly not the please that we have in please be quiet. Okay. Same thing, or very similar thing in 1680. It is laudable to dwell handsomely, but be not too forward to build or set forth another man's house, or so to fill it that it may increase the few. God should please to send fire. Again, something rather different. The development towards today's use takes a little bit longer. Quite a few people have enough of pleasing. Please leave quietly. Here's another please. Okay. I am, so please you, a poor cobbler's wife. As you can see, so please you is almost like an addition. I am a poor cobbler's wife is something that could be said alone. So it's no longer fully integrated into the whole sentence. Here's a letter for the master, if you please, miss. Please, spirit. And you can see that, again, if you please, miss, is sort of an afterthought. And you can then see how it might have become shortened over time, where it just is please. And this is the use that we see about 150 years ago. So we clearly can't say that the use of please is the same over the last few centuries. And that the speech act of request or an indirect request is always done in the same way as we are doing now. Today, these kind of requests are done with could you, can you, would you. Why are they indirect? Well, because this is basically a question about the ability, right? Can you do this? And therefore, it's indirect. But earlier, a couple of hundred years back, it was much more common to say things like, I pray you, or by your favor, or I beseech you, or if it please you. There is the word please again. But it's not just please, but it's part of a whole clause, right? By your leave. And you might see this in earlier drama. I pray you, neighbors. I pray you, good neighbors, let us regard this, etc., etc. What would we use today in these contexts? Please. But in earlier stages of the language, apparently the same kind of politeness message or force of the speech act was not done with a single word, but was done via, one could call them, parenthetical, if you please, or if it pleases you, etc. So, quite clearly, it's not the same over time, and that's why looking at speech acts from a diachronic, from a historical perspective, is not easy. That's how much I wanted to say about speech acts in the history of English. And since I used a couple of bad words before, and since they are related to politeness, even though we saw that they are not exclusively related, or that they are not exclusively connected with impoliteness, I would like to look at the development of rude language over time, or, in fact, as it's called, taboo. Taboo is, people debate where the word taboo comes from, but a lot of people trace it back to Polynesia and other countries in the area. Set apart for or consecrated to a special use or purpose, restricted to the use of a god, a king, priests, or chiefs, while forbidden to general use, prohibited to a particular class, especially to women, or to a particular person or persons, etc., etc. So this is about restricting access, about forbidding access to something. This is taboo. And of course we have taboo in language. We have the prohibition or partial prohibition of the use of certain words in social intercourse. And it's interesting to look at this in a diachronic, from a diachronic perspective. One way to account for taboo is as follows. What does starve mean? Well, it basically goes back to the same word. Well, it's related to sterben. Stirfan. That's to become stiff, which is what happens to a human body when they die. But it's not actually saying dying, but it's describing what's going on. That's because of a taboo to refer to death. To go forth. To pass on. Or to depart. All of these are, of course, euphemisms, which is one way of responding to taboo. Let's have a look at Old English. 1,000 years, 1,500 years ago, there was quite a bit of swearing going on in Old English. But we have little evidence, because there is little evidence for Old English anyway. We have only some poetry, and in poetry, the emphasis was not necessarily on natural interaction. It's dignified restraint of language, as some people call it. But there is quite a difference from the way people swore, if they swore, or from what was meant or what was counted as swearing back then. Because it was basically swearing in a religious sense, swearing by a certain god, okay, rather than swearing at someone. Okay. In fact, that was prohibited. There was censorship when it came to religious swearing. Second commandment was taken very seriously. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. It was considered a very serious offense to say something like, well, actually, if I say holy shit, then that's a combination of both things, the modern and the old one, because holy in the context of swearing was not acceptable in previous times, in Old English. There was a lot of use in Middle English of words that would nowadays be considered rude and taboo. For example, in Chaucer, we find a lot of descriptions that are in fact rather offensive to modern ears, or perhaps to more modern ears. Thus screwed was the carpenter's wife. In spite of all his guarding and his jealousy, and Absalom has kissed her lower eye, and Nicholas is scalded in the arse. Okay. So this is different from blasphemy. This is not about a religious entity. This probably also didn't have the kind of negative implication. It was not rude. It was much more acceptable back then than, let's say, 500 years later. Things changed in the Renaissance. Not only changed in the Renaissance, but it became more regulated. There was a lot of censorship, mostly political, and the Master of Revels was in charge of this. But it also meant that people on stage were very restricted with respect to the oaths and the swearing that they were allowed to say, particularly again in the context of religious context. So there were euphemisms formed that reminded people of religious terms, but that were not actually those terms that were used. In fact, it went so far as to lead to the abolition of public stage play in 1642. There is quite a bit of rude language in Shakespeare, though. Lots of insults. For example, a knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited action taken, horse on glass, gazing, super serviceable, finical road, etc. This is one long insult, okay, but not a religious insult. Lots of innuendo and wordplay. Lady, shall I lie in your lap? No, my lord. I mean my head upon your lap. Eh, my lord. Do you think I meant country matters? That's also... yeah, not just country matters. I think nothing, my lord. That's a fair thought to lie between maid's legs. Clearly lots and lots of sexual innuendo. Which led to changes in Shakespeare, because people later on, in the late modern English period, thought, now you can't expose our poor children and young ladies to this. They came up with the family Shakespeare, where the contents were more acceptable to readers. So out damned spot became out crimson spot. Much more acceptable, as I'm sure you can see. And God became heavens. You again see the reluctance to swear by religious entities. People were also concerned about how to refer to elements that they felt, or to items or things that they felt queasy about. Things like perspiration, urination, micturation, and a few others. Copulation, erection, whatever, intercourse. They're all Latinate, because that sort of removes them from the much more emotive, much more literal, direct Anglo-Saxon words. So by that, they become less dangerous. In the 18th century, we had a period of decorum, where dictionaries were started. Well, dictionaries aren't actually as old as you think. The first dictionaries are from the early modern English period, but before then there were no dictionaries. But then, in the 18th century, the bad words were excluded. And that's still the case in some dictionaries today, particularly in the US dictionaries, because we can't expose our children to this kind of danger. And play censorship continued. You may have heard of Pygmalion. Eliza Doolittle exclaimed on stage, "Not bloody likely." Bloody was just about the worst thing you could say 100 years ago. A whole country was in a race about this. You may also have heard of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was banned because of the use of rude words. And it was only unbanned in the 60s, and some of the words are highlighted here. This just didn't work out before the 1960s. And in fact, theatrical censorship really lasted till 68. So really what we see is today, where these kind of things become much more acceptable, and the F word is, depending on where you are in Britain, one of the most frequent words in a person's vocabulary. But this is really no longer swearing by a religious entity or a god, but this is swearing at. So some people have looked at the development from religious to the lower physical, or not looked at, have described it as a development from the lower physical faculties, from religious to the lower physical faculties of copulation, defecation, and urination. So, religion to swearing at, but in fact, if you look at it in an even bigger perspective, and go back to Roman times, then this sort of closes a circle. And I'd like to play a brief promotional video about a book, which is in fact called Holy Shit, which is about the history of rude language. It makes a few points that I've made before, but it also shows that it's even part of a larger development. And she describes this in a nice way. So 3 minutes of this, and then I'll finish with a few words on cross-cultural communication and politeness.
My name is Melissa Moore. I've written a book called Holy Shit, A Brief History of Swearing. You know these words. You may even have used one or two of them already today. There are a million words in the English language, give or take. How did these particular ones become the words that shock and offend us? Have they always had the same power? The origins of these words might seem mysterious to us today because the charge, the power of swear words, is generated by cultural taboos, which have changed over the years in ways that are not obvious. Holy shit starts in ancient Rome, where swear words got their power from sexual taboos, as many of ours do today. The Roman taboos, though, were very different. A manly thing to do, for example, was to threaten another man with irrimatio, which is basically oral rape and a very bad word. Well, the worst insult that you could throw at a Roman was that he practiced cunnilingus. In the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, the taboos are of course mostly religious, and it was by God more important than obscenities. God is fighting a war for supremacy with other Near Eastern gods, and oath swearing is one of his most powerful weapons. In the Middle Ages and Renaissance, the taboos and thus the swear words are religious. By God's bones, for example, which means almost nothing to us today, was worse in this period than any sexual obscenities, because it was thought to be able to tear apart Christ's physical body as it sits in heaven at the right hand of God. Because the taboos were religious, today's obscene words were not obscene at all, and appeared in places they'd never be seen now, in personal names, in medical texts, and even in translations of the Bible itself. In the Renaissance, the taboos started to switch over and swearing began to look more modern. Fuck, for example, came to replace sard and swive as the direct and eventually shocking word for sex. The Augustan and Victorian eras, the 18th and 19th centuries, were the age of decorum, which paradoxically saw an explosion of obscenity and also a tremendous growth in euphemisms, to the point where in polite society you couldn't even say what to us seems to be a completely inoffensive word like trousers or leg. This led to all kinds of interesting things, including a vogue for botanical pornography and a great fear of the huffle, defined in one 18th century dictionary as a piece of bestiality too filthy for explanation. The 20th century saw the development of racial slurs, as taboos against sex and excrement and on religion grew weaker, and those against essentializing people, defining them by race especially, but also by disability or size, grew stronger. In the 1950s and 60s, comedian Lenny Bruce tried to neutralize swear words by performing routines in which he'd repeat certain ones over and over. The idea was that these would start to sound like mere nonsense words, and that this would rob them of their power. He thought that a world without swear words would be a world without hatred, without sexual hypocrisy, and without violence. After writing this book, I've come to believe pretty much the opposite of Mr. Bruce. Swear words are useful. They are the most powerful words we have to express emotion, whether that emotion is negative or positive. They offer catharsis as a response to pain or to powerful feelings. They cement ties among members of groups in ways that other words cannot. Getting rid of the swear words will not get rid of the hatred, nor of the joy that makes us want to use them. I hope you'll read this book and discover some more of the interesting, funny, even beautiful history of these words.
I haven't read the book, so I can't recommend it, but looks promising. Okay, final few slides on politeness across cultures. One of the claims, or basically, it's one of the main claims of Brown and Levinson is that their approach or their model of politeness as reducing face-threatening acts can be applied universally. But they say that politeness strategies are, of course, culture-dependent. And I've mentioned a few points before, for example, when you show your anger in a certain culture, then that is unacceptable and you lose face. Yeah. Or how you compliment, or whether you compliment or not, is more common in some cultures than in others. Yeah. Refusing is offensive in some cultures, or basically just saying no. I still remember that I was walking around, walking towards a remote island on an remote village on an Indonesian island, and I kept asking people whether there was a bus going back, and they all said mungkin, which means maybe. They knew there was no bus, and we walked all the 4 hours back again. It was not polite for them; it was not acceptable for them to say no. So they rather lied. Well, they didn't really lie, of course. Lie from the perspective of the European, then lose face by saying no. So clearly there is a difference, and we need to take this into account when we look at politeness and how it is affected in language. I was exposed to something like this a while ago when I went to Japan, And I was invited by a colleague. He paid for the flights and he paid for the hotel, etc. And then he also gave me a little bit, a small fee for a talk or something like that. And I was very happy. And I liked it very much in Japan. But then I got an email from him. And maybe you can help me what this means. Can I ask you a very strange question, which I should not ask you now? When you came to Japan to give a demonstration of your BNC web, did I pay you enough money, including travel costs and your lecture? I cannot remember how much I paid you, and I'm very scared to know whether I paid you the amount I told you before you came here. You gave two main lectures, one here in my university with people from outside, and the other at Osaka University, organized by Mr. Tabata. Though it is an awkward question to ask and answer, I am afraid if I did what I said to you. Please feel free to answer. What on earth does that mean? I was really concerned because I clearly felt that this is an issue of cross-cultural communication which failed to a certain extent, because I could imagine that this meant, actually, I paid you too much and I'm not quite sure how I should tell you. In fact, it didn't. But I didn't know, because I simply did not see or did not interpret what clearly seemed to be indirect acts that are being performed here in the same way as he intended them to. It turned out that he just generally felt, or at least that's what he said, it turned out that he generally felt that he hadn't given me enough money, which was completely wrong, but I really did not understand this email. So, clearly, cross-cultural communication can be problematic in the context of such things as face-saving strategies. This is also shown in this constructed dialogue between two businessmen who are meeting for the first time. This is an American and a Chinese. Mr. Richardson says, "By the way, I'm Andrew Richardson. My friends call me Andy. I'm David Chu. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Richardson. This is my card." No, call me Andy. I think we'll be doing a lot of business together." "Yes, I hope so." And then reading Mr. Chu's card, "Chu Hon Fai. Hon Fai, I'll give you a call tomorrow as soon as I get settled at my hotel. And yes, I'll expect your call, smiling." Do you see what's going on here? Quite a bit is going wrong here. This is partly because Mr. Richardson, or Andrew, doesn't know certain rules about Asian names, or rules certain facts about Asian names. A lot of Chinese have a Chinese name, which is partly the same for all members in the family, or all children. Have one aspect or one part of the name is the same, and they often also have a Western, a European, an American name, as Mr. Chu seems to have here. David. And by addressing Mr. Chu with the Chinese name, he's in fact quite rude, because that's a name that you would only use in a family setting. My wife has a Chinese name, she also has a Western name, but the only people who call her by her Chinese name are the members of her family. Okay. Clearly this causes some problems. And also, of course, the interpretation of the smiling, Mr. Richardson might be quite happy with the way things went, and he didn't realize that he's actually been rather rude, but of course the message again that is performed by smiling may not be the same. So we can see that on various levels there might be miscommunication. Now some of these are more or less linguistic. Here is a really linguistic one, which often causes trouble, apparently, when Western and Eastern businessmen or businesswomen interact. Who is this written by? Who is this said by? An Asian or an American? Because most of our production is done in China now, and it's not really certain how the government will react in the run-up to 1997. That was when Hong Kong went back to China. And since I think a certain amount of caution in committing to TV advertisement is necessary because of the expense, so I suggest that we delay making our decision until after LECCO makes its decision. Is this written by a Chinese or an Asian, or is this written, or said, rather, by an American? Well, it's written... No, why do I always say written? It's spoken by an Asian, and notice how the important point comes at the end. So I suggest that we delay making our decision. This is a completely different strategy in ordering elements in conversation. Now, this is of course now presented as very black and white. It's not the case that all Asians always say the most important thing last. This is, of course, please don't get me wrong here, but this seems to be a strategy which is different from what could be termed, let's call it the Western strategy. I suggest that we delay making our decision until after LECCO makes its decision. That's because. Now, if you've got this kind of expectation of discourse strategy, and you are met, you're talking to someone who's actually using a completely different discourse strategy, then you may think, oh, he's just not being very clear. He never makes the point that he needs to make, etc., etc. But this is really simply because of the way information is structured. Now, this hasn't got anything to do with politeness, but it still has got to do with structure, and in particular, it's got to do with structure of discourse. And this is something that we will be talking about next week when we look at discourse analysis or conversation analysis. See you next Friday.